a kin picture where and when you were born?
Born in London, 9th December 1942.
And what were the names of your parents?
Florence Ada and James Robert.
And what did your father do for a living?
Father was a cabinet maker.
So no family connections with the city?
None whatsoever, no.
Did you know your grandparents?
I knew my grandparents,
what,
yes.
What had they done?
During their lives, my grandmother worked in a paint factory and grandfather worked in a rubber company.
Mm. Where, did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have one sister who, in fact, works in the city. She's in the city at the moment with a commodity broker.
Mm. And where were you living as a...
As a child, spent most of my childhood in Upper Clapton, which is East Fife.
And where did your parents send you for your education?
Local school, which was Daubeny Road School, and then following that, senior school was Parmiter's Grammar School in Bethnal Green, E2.
Would you say your parents had influenced your life in any particular way?
Very difficult to answer that, but certainly when I started in the city, I had no idea at that stage exactly what I was going to do. I was waiting for examination results, and I thought perhaps I might be a chartered accountant, but in the interim period, I remember coming to an agency called St Paul's Agency in Coxwell Avenue, and they sent me off to a firm called Bird and Gosjork, where I started employment and stayed there for a number of years until we merged.
So while you had been at school, you hadn't had any definite ideas about what you'd like to do as a career?
No definite plans at that stage, no.
You mentioned that you were doing a few jobs in the city before you actually started with Berger.
No, that was the only job.
That was the only job?
Yes.
So what did you do when you finished school?
Well, I finished school, must have been July time, and didn't do anything for a few weeks, and then, as I say, came up to the city to an employment agency, who, and from them sending me to Berger and Gosjork, that's where I started. Mm.
What attracted you to the city? Was it the nearest employment agency?
It was not necessarily the nearest, but I must have had some thoughts of going into the city. Can't really remember why, but I must have had some thoughts. But to do exactly what the city was all about was foreign. I mean, it didn't mean very much to me at all.
What would you say the attitude to money had been at home?
The attitude to money? What respect do you mean?
Well, was it a family that was fairly careful with money, or
I think it was a family that had to be careful with money. Mm. Mm.
So, can you remember roughly the date it was when you did start with?
Yep, I started on the 24th of August, 1959.
And what were the first jobs that they had you doing?
The obvious ones, I mean, the cliche you always hear, tea boy, but literally one had to make the tea. Man the switchboard and run stock around the offices in the city. When I say run stock around the offices in the city, that was delivering bearer bonds and transfers down to the centralised stock payment department. But it really was at the bottom, as such.
What kind of interview had you had for the job?
Very straightforward, very simple interview that the job was there for a clerk, and I took it. And then things fortunately developed from then on.
Who actually would have interviewed you? Would it have been one of the partners?
It would have been the general manager. It was an office job rather than a job on the stock exchange floor.
How would you describe the firm when you joined it? Was it a big firm?
It was a medium-sized firm, trading primarily in mining stocks. They were very, very, very good in copper shares, gold mines, etc.
Were they South African stocks, Rhodesian stocks?
South African and Rhodesian, both.
Were they an old firm?
I think when I joined them, they were probably about 35 years, that's that sort of time.
And do you have any recollection of what the offices were like?
Yeah, we lived in, we started in Warnford Court, which is in Throgmorton Street. They were very small offices, and as jobbers in those days, we didn't have clients. So obviously overheads were kept to a minimum.
And how long did they have you doing the office jobs?
They had me doing the office jobs for approximately 15 months.
What did you progress to?
And then
that?
I got the opportunity to go onto the stock exchange floor to represent the firm. Then was what was known as a blue button.
And what was involved in being a blue button?
Blue button, the job then was to book bargains, keep positions up to date, running bull bears and all the different stocks, and to go and bid and offer stock to brokers. Then we had stands in the old stock exchange floor, what we used to call a stand, where a waiter stood, and you'd go to a waiter and ask for a name of a gentleman with a certain firm. He'd shout out the gent's name, and you'd either bid him for some stock or offer him some stock, because he'd given us what we used to call a limit, indicating that if a share got to a certain price, he'd like to sell it or buy it.
Do you have any early recollections of going into the stock exchange as a blue button?
Only the first recollection I can remember having was going to this enormous place with lots and lots of people running around, making lots of noise, and just feeling totally and completely lost. And we weren't allowed to sit down. And I can remember at the end of the first couple of days, back, legs, everything ached enormously. But after a short period of time, that sort of looked after itself.
By this stage, presumably, you knew what a jobbing firm did and you knew what the stock exchange did.
Beginning to understand what the stock exchange did, but obviously knew what the jobbing business was, on the basis that sort of coming up through the office and seeing the settlement side and bits and pieces, that one sort of grasped that we were principals, and we made our living from making two-way prices, buying and selling shares.
How did you feel about having gone into a stock exchange firm? Were you quite happy with that kind of career?
I think once one got onto the stock exchange floor, yes, was the answer. It was exciting. Very exciting.
How would you describe the particular part of the stock exchange where Berger and Gosschalk had their pitch? Was it were there many jobbers in that particular market?
Yeah, we had a few pitches on the trading floor. One of our main pitches, or two or three of our main pitches, were under a dome, quite a high dome, and it was pretty spacious, that part of the market, and there were quite a few jobbing firms dealing in mining shares standing in that area, that vicinity.
Was it quite a competitive market?
Rhodesians and Kaffirs, very much so. But in 1961, we started in the property share market from scratch, and I joined that pitch as a blue button, and have been associated with property shares ever since.
Were you standing with any particular partner or group of partners?
Yeah, I used to stand there with the senior partner and another senior partner. There were three partners in all, three partners and myself, a dealer. So three partners, a dealer, myself, and another blue button.
Do you have any recollections of the senior partners at that time?
Oh yes, yes, very much.
Could you perhaps elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, the senior partner then was Edmund Berger. Another partner named Ian McClay. And after a period of time, the pitch was joined by a partner named Anthony Franklin, and Ian McClay moved into a different market, and later joined by another partner, Ken Ling.
How would you describe them as jobbers?
Very good, extremely good. And we probably had a reputation in the early days of being known as bear jobbers. I mean, it has been joked about that most bear jobbers were bear jobbers because they couldn't afford to be ball jobbers, but we probably, as a firm, more than most, would take opportunities on the bear tack.
And how would you describe the firm itself? Was it a family firm?
Edmund Berger's father, Julian Berger, actually started the firm, if I can remember, with his partner then was Jack Goschalk.
And was it still a family firm in the sense that a lot of people related to the original founding partners were
employed by? No, it wasn't
employed by.
Not necessarily, no.
What was its attitude to the future? You had firms like Durlacher and Aykroyd beginning to expand and build their capital base.
We'd done a similar thing because we merged with two firms. One was an oil specialist firm, Ricardo Isaacson Bray, and we also merged with a firm specializing in paper shares.
What was the name?
Page and Blomfield.
Had this happened while you were still in the office or while you were a blue
button? This happened while I was on the trading floor.
Mm-hmm. So the senior partners themselves were taking a fairly positive view on the future?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Did you get that feeling being a part of the firm, that it was a firm that was
expanding,
seeking to expand?
Oh, very much so, very much so. Mm. And we'd had a few successful years, and we were expanding.
Were there any particular markets that you were trading in that were providing you with the main source of your profits? I mean,
we'd always had good income from mining shares, but the property share market started to become quite valuable to us. We made profits from textile shares when there were then a hell of a lot of textile companies, unlike there are now, but we were profitable in most areas.
And how did your, what was the next step for you? You'd become a blue button.
Next step is to become authorised, and to be authorised, if I can remember, I think you had to do a minimum of 2 years blue buttoning, and round about 2 years, or perhaps a wee bit more, I was authorised in January 64.
How did you feel about that? Was it something you were
happy
about? Oh,
absolutely. I mean, it was very exciting, terribly exciting.
Again, can you elaborate a little bit?
On the basis that, unlike being a blue button, you actually stood virtually in the same position during the day, and your job was to make the prices.
Did you feel ready to do that?
By then, yes, because you watch, listen, and and we had some very good teachers, extremely good teachers, very, very fortunate. And being that sort of age, you really can't wait to get at it. It's exactly what you can do or you can't do.
Who were the people that did influence you as a jobber?
Within the firm, it would have been the senior partner, Edmund Berger, and another senior partner, Anthony Franklin, and Ken Ling would have been the main influences.
In what ways did they influence you? What do you think were the qualities that they passed on to you?
Main qualities was to be polite, because the brokers were our customers. To be aware. Probably keep pretty steady under extreme conditions. And under those extreme conditions, look for that to be an opportunity to make a bit of money, in fact. But and discipline yourselves, in so much that we had limits on the size of books that we should be running, and it really was disciplining yourself to those sizes of positions. And I think the other very important thing was not necessarily the bargains that you did, was to learn the bargains that you didn't want to do, which was just as important as the ones you did do, in fact.
Do any examples of that come to mind? Or
well, when I say bargains you don't want to do it, if you have, to a degree, I think probably market makers have a certain amount of gut feeling. And if a broker wanted to buy a large amount of shares and the gut feeling was such that it felt wrong, you didn't do it. And now and again, there probably been bargains you should have done, but generally speaking, you relied on your judgment, and it paid off.
How did you avoid doing the broker's business? Presumably you had to quote the two-way price, didn't you?
I had to quote the two-way price, but you'd sense what the price was with the opposition. Although you didn't know, you'd sense what he was making, although he may have been juggling around with his board and putting red up when he was really calling the price up. But you get the feeling of perhaps the other market makers' positions or books that you yourself might have a price on the screen, but when the broker asked you, you could make a higher price. It didn't have to be the price that was up on the board. You could actually make what you want to do when the broker came to you. So in a way, I think probably the word for it is, I think we used to call it shooting. And you'd be asked this price, and if you just thought the guy was going to be a buyer and you didn't want to sell them, you would just lift the price.
Mm. Was all this a standard part of one's jobbing technique, to use the prices on one's board?
There was a certain amount of spoof played on the boards, absolutely. Mm. And if you had sold a reasonable amount of stock and you sensed that the other competing jobbers were looking at the board and looking at it was wandering on the pitch and wandering off the pitch, you might then use your board to try and spoof the price lower and not give away the fact that you had sold them, but rather give the impression that you'd bought them.
Was there any way of knowing what the prices your opposition were quoting, other than looking at their boards? I mean, with brokers occasionally.
Brokers weren't allowed to tell you really what another market maker, another jobber then, was making, but we used to have countrymen in those days, and they had lists. And certainly in stocks where there was quite a lot of shunting between London and the country, they would keep their lists updated with the other jobbing firms. And it was really a practice that was accepted. But outside that, brokers weren't really allowed to disclose another jobber's quotation, but although he did have to let you know if there was a backwardation before he dealt, and the backwardation was when one job was bidding more than you were offering that. That would be a backwardation, you'd have to disclose as a backwardation.
Was that generally a rule that people adhered to?
Oh, absolutely, yep. Oh, I mean, if it was found out the guy had dealt on a backwardation without telling you, there was a price to pay. So.
When you say countrymen, do you mean brokers dealing
brokers,
with country exchanges?
Yeah, shunting between London, Manchester, Liverpool. Mm. Certainly in textile shares, there was quite a lot of business up in Manchester, Leeds, where the textile companies were based.
And did the shunting continue right through?
Shunting continued for quite a few years, yeah. Mm. But began to peter out towards Big Bang, really.
Did you have much contact with brokers doing arbitrage business?
Yeah, we had what was then known as arbitrage. I'm not quite sure how you define arbitrage now, but arbitrage then would certainly in international stocks, such as Rhodesian stocks, there would be a market in Rhodesia and a market in London, and brokers would arbitrage between the two centres. And if they could sell the stock well in Rhodesia, they would buy it if they could, but normally I mean that they could buy it cheaper from London, and communications then weren't anywhere near as good as they are now. I think ticker tapes used to fly backwards and forwards, but now you press a button and you know exactly who's making what throughout the world. But that was a form of arbitrage. The other form of arbitrage that jobbers would take part in themselves would be on takeover bids, where most of them were share exchanges. And there was, which still exists now, situations where a jobber would sell the company that was doing the bidding and buy the company that was being bid for company that was being bid for shares on the share exchange would make them cheaper than what the bid was worth. So when the deals finally went through, the two share prices would come together. So that's a form of arbitrage that the jobbers did then and still do now as market makers.
Was there ever a potential for a jobber to get caught out in the sense that he would be short of a stock involved in a takeover situation and find that the stock that he's been short of has suddenly been going up?
That would happen, absolutely, yes. I think it happened, I'm not 100% sure, but I think one jobbing firm may have ceased trading for that very reason, that they were bears of a stock that was bid for and cost them a lot of money.
Did you, even though you were in the property market, know much about the other side of the firm's business in the sense of the mining business?
Yeah, we used to, well, it was mining, went far along, there's mining, textiles, oil, papers, hire purchase, insurance. But as dealers, we would meet in the mornings in the coffee shop and just chat to one another and say what was going on. And that would also happen on the stock exchange floor. We'd meet, or we might meet at lunch or whatever, and we'd just chat about what was going on in our various sectors.
Did the markets have very distinctive characteristics? For example, was the Rhodesian market very different to the property market in which you were involved in? For example, did you have open bidding or open offering of stock?
I can't ever remember open bidding ever taking place in a property share market, but it certainly used to take place in the Rhodesian and South African market, where the jobber would stand up bidding a stock up or offering it down, for that matter. But we had a caricature of our senior partner's, then senior partner's father, standing in the market bidding 3/8 for Rio. And we had that on the wall in the office, in the partner's room. But that's obviously a tragic. See, I think he was known as somebody that would openly bid or offer on the stock exchange floor.
I believe the shops were very important in the different mining markets.
The
shops.
The brokers to the brokers to the companies. I think probably they may be, but mining shares, although I knew a bit about, weren't really the speciality as such. As not spending a great deal of time on that on that pitch.
The final thing I want to ask you on that side is: did Berger have agents in the, say, the New York Exchange or the?
Not then. We used to do most of our business in Rhodesia. I think it was done through Standard and Chartered, or in Hollard Street. I think it was Hollard Street in Joburg. Maybe, I can't really remember, something like that.
Do you remember your partners ever going out to Rhodesia or South Africa?
They occasionally, the partners would go out and see the copper mines. I think in those days there was a company called Bancroft, Rakana, RST, and Changa, and they would go out to visit the copper mines. But I think they'd probably only have sort of go once. It wouldn't have been a regular visit.
By the same token, did the dealers or the partners who were involved in domestic equities, did they ever have any contact with the companies in which, in whose stocks they were dealing?
Not a great deal, no. They would use kind of more senior people with, or their senior broking friends with broking firms to, that's where the business was done. And I think in those early days to have had a lot of communication with companies. Some firms did, but I think we probably would have taken the view that too much communication may have sort of antagonised stockbrokers, which, worse, I say, they were our livelihood.
It's been said that before the brokers began to set up their own research departments, that the jobbers used to be the people who they went to for information. Do you think there was any truth of that in your experience?
We used to keep fly sheets to each stock that we dealt in. On the fly sheet, it would give dividend dates, it would give ex-dividend dates, it would have a brief summary of what the company did. And brokers, dealers would wander up to the market, or jobber, and you literally told him what the company did, when the dividends were due, and goodness knows what. But it's the information that we kept ourselves. And not just doing it for a service to the brokers, we found it totally important to ourselves.
In what sense?
So that we actually knew that a dividend was going to be due in a couple of weeks' time, rather than finding out it was tomorrow. So if you thought you ought to do something or get a book position because you thought the figures might have been good, or you thought the figures may not be so good, whatever, you were always aware of when these dividends were due to be declared, the figures.
Did you feel it was important to have information about the companies at your fingertip? Did it help you as a trader?
It helped to be aware of dates when things were going to happen. I think that was probably more than, I mean, it was very difficult for us to understand in those days what a PE was and this knows what, but if we knew we were coming up to a dividend period, it may a sort of pattern that a share or two or three shares during their run-up to their dividends, the price normally went better until the day of the dividend and the figures, and then after the figures were out, the share price normally came back. Well, if that was a pattern, then you'd want to be a bull for that run, and then you'd want to make sure you were out by the time those figures were actually declared. Mm. So there was a lot of importance attached to knowing when these figures were all due. Mm.
Well, let me revert to your career as a dealer. Were you given your own book when you started as a dealer, or were you with a group of people working on the same book?
I was with a group of people to start with on the same book. Then after a period of time, I did get my own book on the property pitch to deal in. And it was probably after a period, perhaps a year to 15 months, that sort of time. Mm. And we had, the way we remunerated ourselves in those days was that we had what one would have thought pretty low salaries, but we got percentages of pitches that we worked on. And I think the advantage to that was the fact that to a degree, as it was your own money, and you did actually try and make sure you made money. It was a bit of a spur.
Do you recall any successes or any